And what we have found over the years is that a lot of our colleagues say, my hardest year teaching was year two, because it felt like all the support systems just kind of went away. And they weren't wrong, Jim. So what we have started doing this year is we have started making a very overt and concerted effort to support our year two folks, not in the same way as year one, but in a very structured and predictable way, so that it didn't feel like those training wheels just kind of wobbled off the road. And so what we've been doing is using your work, using our coaching cycles, but carrying the thread through year two. And it has just helped us so much do exactly what we talked about before in our conversation. Hold on to that relationship that we established in year one, continue it, strengthen it, and make sure that we are continuing on that collegial relationship in a really meaningful, authentic way. It's made such a difference in teaching and learning.
I'm Jim Knight, co-founder of the Instructional Coaching Group, and you're listening to Coaching Conversations, where I talk with coaching experts from around the world so that all of us can learn better ways to make an unmistakably positive impact on the people around us.
Hi, everyone. It's ICG consultant Jessica Wise, host of the Coaching Questions on the Coaching Conversations podcast with Jim Knight, here to talk about our virtual workshop titled System Support, What Administrators Need to Know. We know that the impact coaches have is directly related to how effectively they are supported or not supported by their administrators. For that reason, it is crucial that administrators participate in professional development that clarifies what coaches do and how they can be supported. Our virtual workshop, System Support, will provide administrators with everything they need to know about instructional coaching. Join us to learn about the partnership principles that guide coaches' interactions with teachers, the 6 specific actions administrators can take to support coaches effectively, the 5 simple truths of helping, and more. Join us or learn more by visiting instructionalcoaching.com.
Suzanne, I'm so grateful you're here. Last year at TLC, your presentation brought the house down. It was a standing room only. Your dad was in the audience. and I've heard nothing but stellar reviews about the whole presentation. So I'm excited for your presentation this year at TLC. And I think your work on happiness is a work for our times. As I look around, people seem to be more alone, angry, polarized, more worried than ever before. At least ever before in my lifetime, and that's quite a while. And teachers in particular in this post-COVID world, they seem to be especially confronted by the challenges that can decrease happiness. And so this reason, because Teach Happier This School Year is a book for the times, I'm excited to talk about your ideas and how they can be applied particularly to helping new teachers. So let's start, if it's okay, with talking about happiness in general.
I love your realistic approach. The World Happiness Report just came out in March, and we're all decreasing, really, in Western civilization. We're moving down in our happiness, and it's because of what you referenced, loneliness. A lot of us just feel lonely. And so what does that mean for us, especially as coaches, right? We're supposed to be nurturing those and supporting others. So what is there so that it helps us feel supported as well? And so we say the word happiness, we kind of toss it around, but what we really mean by that is feeling anchored and grounded and just a little steadier in an unsteady world. And so in order to do that, we have to acknowledge exactly what you're talking about, acknowledging the loneliness, acknowledging the isolation, and acknowledging that we really do need each other to do our important work, whether that's teaching, whether that's coaching, whether that's parenting, whatever our important roles are in our buildings and outside of our buildings as well.
So there's a World Happiness Report?
There is, every single year. And it ranks every country where they are. And then it really digs deeper into what are some of those practices that some of those happiest countries do. So no surprise, we've got Denmark, Finland, and Sweden at the top 3 this year.
I saw a few years ago, they were interviewing people in Finland and they said, why are you so happy? And they said, we have low expectations. So everything's like, okay. So, well, It wasn't that great, but I didn't have my expectations anyway, so I'm pretty happy with that. So I think we just had to lower our expectations. Maybe that's all it's going to take.
Keep the bar low, right? Keep so we can just low. Clear it with one small step.
Put that on a t-shirt. Keep the bar low. I do want to talk about happiness in general. And you and I, when we were at ASCD, we had a conversation with a fellow. Mm-hmm. And he said to you, after you said, I study happiness, he said, well, I don't believe in happiness. So I wonder what you think. Is life all about happiness? Is there more than that?
Oh, there's so much more than that. So this is an and situation, right? It's not a matter of, do I want to go through my day feeling happy? Or do I want to go through my day feeling crappy? Like, that's not, if this is an and situation, we are going to more than likely have a little bit of both in every single day. And so depending on the season that we're in, professionally or personally, we have to discern our next right thing and be a part of our own rescue so that we can feel, again, not happy, not tra-la-la, good vibes only, steady, grounded, anchored, aligned, balanced, as much as we realistically can. Some days it's easier than others, but every day it's work to move through our days in a pretty healthy headspace and heart space. Doesn't come as naturally to most of us.
I really love this singer, Nancy Griffith. You know, I was thinking about this today. You just made me think about this. When she has a song called The Radio or something about the radio. And she said, okay. if you can't find a friend, find a radio. And then it's all about where would I be without the songs Loretta wrote. And this person she's leaving Mississippi in the morning time. And she said, her husband's sitting on the sofa looking for his supper, wondering what's become of me. But she has this mixture of happiness and sadness in this song, sort of resilience and perseverance. And she gets joy out of the music at the same time as she's feeling sad. And as I was thinking about this weekend, I thought, this is probably going way off tack already, but I was just thinking, that is the experience. Margaret Wheatley, in the new book she wrote, she said, you know, it makes sense people would be sad. Sad is kind of a natural thing, but you don't want to have more sad. And maybe to some extent, sadness and happiness are both sides of the same coin or something like that. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's what I've been thinking about.
It's a fully lived life. We're going to experience all of it. And one of my most recent podcast episodes, I have a podcast called Teach Happier. We're kind of going against some of those platitudes that we hear. And the last one we just kind of hit on the head was everything happens for a reason. And we ended it early and everything happens, period, hard stop. And it's not because we're doing anything wrong. It's actually because we're doing it right and we're leaning into our people and our work and causes we care deeply about. And if we're going to do that, well, the price of admission is sometimes it's going to feel really great and sometimes it's going to feel really hard.
Yeah, this stuff seems to me even more significant in schools right now. So I'm wondering, do you think it's going too far to say we're experiencing a crisis of happiness in schools? And what are you seeing in schools as you work with the schools you work with?
I don't think it's an exaggeration, sadly. I would love to say it is, but I really don't think it is. Realistically, teachers, and I'm teaching every day, so I'm boots on the ground, and I also understand that the strategies that worked for us 5 years ago aren't cutting it as well as they were before. So our little toolbox of effective strategies need to evolve and change. That's a heavy lift. That's a heavy cognitive and emotional and oftentimes physical lift, especially in elementary classrooms, which is where I spend most of my time. And to just go back into your classroom again and again, wondering, is this going to work today? Is it not going to work today? It's almost that energy and that doubt and vulnerability from our early years in teaching are resurfacing for some of our most veteran and masterful teachers. And that's just really tiring. And showing up day after day, no matter what's happening in our personal lives, trying to show up for kids in the most genuine and authentic way is exhausting enough. But now add on that additional layer of trying new strategies, kind of having some false starts, which we weren't experiencing 5, 6 years ago. And then also that additional pressure that we're getting always from what are our districts expecting of us, our state, our community. It's just more, 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 more. And that's heavy.
And it's all happening in a context that's getting worse too. I mean, our conversation about happiness is sounding pretty dark right now.
It's but really anyway, taking the left turn.
Well, but I mean, there's misinformation. So it's hard to know what's true and what's not true because everybody's putting their own spin on it for selfish reasons. There's intense polarization. There's self-centeredness. I mean, and there's so much anger and rage. I mean, you have people upset about what kind of phone you use or what sports team you cheer for that they're really, really angry about it. And you know, when you see all of this happening around you, it just makes it harder. And I think sort of sadness, as Margaret Wheatley would say, is kind of the appropriate response. If you have your eyes open, there should be some sadness. But that doesn't mean we have to surrender. It means we want to do what we can to make sense of it. So I have this sort of general question. I'm asking for a friend. So if you had somebody who wanted to become happier, what are some basic habits, routines that person that I'm talking about could take care of themselves? What are some simple habits or routines that would help us be a little bit happier?
Well, the good news is Suzanne Daly doesn't have to make any of this up because there's so much research out there to help us. There's universal practices of happiness. And then it's becoming still enough to know what do we need to do to have a good day on purpose, with purpose. And that takes work and that takes thought. But to me, there's no greater place to put our time, effort, or energy. So there's just a few things. I'll share the two biggest universal practices right now. And one of them's kind of easy and one of them's kind of annoying. Which one do you want first?
Well, let's go annoying.
Wonderful. So the annoying one is going to be exercise. Mm. So there, all the research will point to if you want to be well mentally and emotionally, you need to be well physically. And so what does that mean for most folks? It probably means one of two things, moving your body or being outside in nature. And what that does for our happiness chemicals, the dopamine, the serotonin, I mean, fMRI scans will prove this to us. So my least favorite happiness practice, but it's something I do every day, is I move my body. One of the first things I do in the morning, I wake up before anyone in my house. You and I have talked about this, Jim. I have a quiet cup of coffee without any words. And then I'm either outside or in the basement just moving my body because I know that when I do that, even though I hate exercising, I love to have exercised because now I know the morning Suzanne that exercises, the afternoon and evening Suzanne wins because I'm more patient, I'm more present, I'm a little more regulated. And I will move through my days in a much more healthy way if I have moved my body in the morning.
I find that, like if I go running, which I'm not really doing right now, I'm doing walking because I'm not ready for running, but it's coming. But when I go running, I find like about one out of every 20 times is really joyful. That runner's high. People talk about the runner's high. I seem to have it like once every 20 times. And so I was running on the levee here in Lawrence, Kansas. And, it's like 6 a.m. in the morning. The sun's coming up. It's cool. I just feel awesome. I'm listening to Bruce Springsteen. And he's got this song, The Promised Land. And the chorus is, "Honey, I'm not a child. I'm a man. And I believe in the promised land." And I just belt it out, singing at the line. I can't sing at all, but at the top. And then this person runs right past me just as I belt it out. So that was my experience with trying to. Then I wasn't happy anymore when she kind of smiled. Okay, so that's.
But Jim, we're not always looking for happiness high, right? Like. Right. We said earlier, the bar is low. We're just looking to move the needle this much. The dial is a 2-degree shift. That's all we're looking for. If we can feel just a little bit better, that's a win.
Hi, everyone. It's Jessica Wise, host of the Coaching Questions on the Coaching Conversations podcast with Jim Knight. As a teacher and a coach, I am here to say that there are many challenges that we face on a daily basis. You might be wondering how to address these challenges. One way is to join the instructional coaching group team in the Impact Cycle virtual workshop, where we talk about tools instructional coaches can use to support teaching and learning. This course is the product of over 20 years of research that provides a framework for any coaching scenario. Join us in this 2-day workshop to learn about the complexities of helping adults, distinguish among different types of coaching approaches, dive into the 3 stages of the impact cycle, learn about the power of getting a clear picture of current reality, and how peers' goals can dramatically change the impact teachers have on student engagement and achievement. To learn more, visit instructionalcoaching.com.
Clear that low bar.
Lower the bar. That's it. Okay. So the second thing, what's the second thing?
Is gratitude. We have hundreds of thousands of data points that point to our most joyful people and our most resilient people will all practice gratitude. It's all the data points that way. So it's, I think it's not annoying, as annoying as exercise, because exercise, that's going to take, that's like a 20 to 30 minute something. Gratitude is a 10 second something. So I start my day with exercise. I end my day with gratitude. Here's how that works. It's all letter R's. I move through my day and I try and recognize the good things that happen. So my head is always on a swivel trying to find not what's going wrong, what's going right. So I recognize it in the moment. And when I do that, Jim, I kind of savor it. Sometimes I'll even say to the person, you know what? This is going in my gratitude book tonight. I recognize it when it happens. I recall it at the end of the day and I record it somewhere. I keep an old school notebook because I've been doing that since 1997. So again, I've worked really hard at this, but a lot of folks I know use an app. One of the most popular ones is called Happy Feed. And here's what I love. I've heard from people who they're in a line or they're just killing time waiting for their kid coming out of practice. And instead of just mindlessly scrolling social media, they scroll with their past gratitudes. So they see pictures or phrases of things that they remember went right in their life. And so what that does is literally carve new neural pathways in our brains. And it's starting to create that pattern of, ooh, good things have happened in the past. Good things are happening right now in the present. And so what does that automatically help us lean towards? Anticipating good things to happen in the future. And that's not like a toxic positivity, no bad things are happening. It just helps us train and pay attention and lean into the things that are going right. That's how I want to spend my day.
What's the first R?
Recognize. You recognize.
Okay, recognize. What's the second one?
Recall.
Recall and record.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Very cool.
And here's what. It's real easy to do on really great days, but it's really difficult to write in your gratitude journal or find something to be grateful for on some of the hardest days. But that's the work, and that's when it causes permanent positive change. I think, Jim, some of the saddest days of my life, you know, somebody I love passed away. Maybe my child went through something really heartbreakingly hard. I still wrote in that journal.
I think it was you that taught me this. Someone taught me that what we pay attention to is who we are. And so if we pay attention to things to be grateful for, we see the positive things, we're going to have a more positive experience. Doesn't mean that to me, toxic positivity is not seeing the real person, not really acknowledging where they are. This isn't about that. This is about just being intentional about what you pay attention to.
Yeah, anything is minimized or maximized depending on how much attention we give it. So why wouldn't we try to give attention to things that are going right? Because then that's what we'll focus on.
So if we're educators, we're resources for other people. If we're teachers, we're working with children. If we're coaches, we're working with teachers, possibly children. If we're administrators, we're working with everybody. How does paying attention to the things we're grateful for, how does focus on health and happiness help us be better resources for other people? It's a bit of a leading question, but I'd like to hear your answer.
Sure. So especially in education, whether we're teachers, coaches, administrators, that's a very outward giving profession, right? We're constantly giving, providing, nurturing. Well, we really can only do that when we're coming from a steady, grounded place. We've all come to work when we feel like a cat with a ball of string and we are not well. We're not our best teachers, coaches, administrators. But when we can walk in feeling as steady as possible, then that's when we can be intentional, present, patient, kind, maintain perspective, and that takes work. So when we walk into our days recognizing here are some things in my life that are going well, we can control that. We have influence and impact over that. A lot of what comes at us during the day, we don't have impact or influence on what comes at us. But as that role as teacher, coach, administrator, we're always a thermostat. We always have to either rise up or come on down, depending on what's given to us. That takes an extreme amount of work and output. And so if we can come at that as steady as possible, that will allow us to have the capacity to serve the people in front of us and how they need to be served.
It really makes a lot of sense that if we're more intentional about how we direct our attention and we do other things that help us feel healthier, we're going to be more able to carry the burdens of other people or at least share in what they're dealing with in a way that's not a burden on them. If I'm just feeling really burnt out, it's harder for me to be the best kind of support I can be. And I wanted to ask specifically about coaches, because a lot of people who listen to this are coaches.
Yeah.
What are the real challenges coaches are facing with respect to being happy? And what are some tips you've got about what coaches can do to persevere and to continue to be of service to others? And I just want to say, I think that's extremely important that they're of service to others, because when a coach works with a teacher, it's not just this year's students. It's every student that teacher ever teaches. And so if a coach is struggling to persevere, hundreds, maybe thousands of students Sure. aren't getting the benefit. So what are the challenges coaches face and what can they do about them?
Well, it depends how many teachers you get to work with. Just a couple of days ago, there's a small group of us in our school district who our jobs are somewhat of a role of an instructional coach in different capacities. And we had a really great conversation of our glows and grows. And almost all of us, our grows, where we wanted to get better at was not only initiating the relationship, but sustaining that relationship with others. And so we started talking, Jim, about how do you not only establish, but then continue to strengthen a relationship, a collegial relationship over years and years, so that you can be a resource, a trusted resource for colleagues. And so we just started talking about really easy things that we can do to help us manage that. For example, your phone, I have the reminder app. Anytime I go through a school, I get to coach in 15 elementary schools. If I pass somebody and I hear somebody say something great to one of their students, I'll jot it down in my reminders app, and then I'll follow that up with an email. Or if I know that a colleague of mine, something big is coming up in their personal life, maybe it's a really, really great thing, or maybe it's a really, really scary thing, I'll actually put it on my calendar so that I remember to reach out to them or just check back in with them after the thing has happened. And what we've learned as we started to unpack that as a little group of instructional coaches, that's when the relationships become so genuine and valued and more that mutually beneficial relationship. And when that happens, then we as coaches can become such a more natural and integrated part of our colleagues' classrooms, which is when all the magic and important work can occur. That can't happen, though, unless that relationship is established and sustained.
Mm-hmm.
But that takes work, right?
Yes, it takes work. I love the idea of using your phone that way, too. That's really, really cool. Now, your book came out a year ago. It's a bestseller. It's up there with Stephen King and other kinds of books in terms of popularity.
Ours low, don't forget.
That's right. So I'm sure you're hearing from people that have read your book. What are a couple stories you've heard from people about their experience of your book, reading your book? And let me just say, I love the book. I love the stories at the beginning, and it's, you know, it's organized around 40 different sections. And so you can, I mean, I'm not proposing you do this, but you could flip through the book pretty quickly and get a really good sense of what it's about, and then come back and go deeper after you go through. But within about an hour of just skimming, you could have a real good sense of what's there, and then you could come back and dive in. But anyway, what are you hearing from people who've read the book?
Well, what I love is I love when people say to me, it's realistic, right? Because some of the stories that you just referenced are, I talk about that these last few years of my life have been the hardest. And so I got to share through the book some of the strategies that helped me move through a really challenging season, both personally and professionally. And I love that you say that you can kind of zoom through it. That's very intentional. It's 40 weeks to mimic a typical school year, but each section, each little chapter, if you will, is maybe 3 to 4 pages, sometimes even as short as 2, because as educators, as busy educators, we just don't have the capacity to sit down and like read a heavy book. And so what the design is, you know, you get those Sunday scaries, you open that book, you read a 2 to 3 page passage, and then be intentional to set a goal for yourself for that upcoming week. So what I love, Jim, is when I hear from folks saying, hey, I tried the even if strategy, and oh, has that made a difference to me as a teacher and to my students? And I actually shared it with my family at home around the dinner table. We're using it at home. And so a quick 30-second summary of the even if strategy is you take your what ifs, you know, what if my headphones run out of battery, which I just heard they said low battery, while I am interviewing with Jim Knight. And you evolve to even if, okay, even if the battery goes low, I'm sure Jim and I can figure it out. He'll let me charge, or we'll do it without the fancy microphone. And what that does, that little language shift, is allows us to understand what is our next right thing if that thing happens. It doesn't get us stuck in that what if, what if, what if. It helps us have some agency in our life, which positive psychologists tell us we have a whole lot more agency than many of us maybe realistically or naturally believe.
Yeah, it's worry doesn't powering. It is, yeah. Powering. Worry really doesn't affect the outcome very much. So I can see that, but I hadn't thought of it quite that way, but how people would sort of hold on to these strategies and then use them all the time, and going through it week by week in a school year. Not that you have to wait till next year to start, but you could use it however you want it as you work your way through. Now, you mentioned that the last few years have been difficult, and you've gone through some difficult things that you talk about pretty transparently in the book, and that's pretty compelling. If I'm a coach and I'm working with someone who's going through difficult times, what should I do and what shouldn't I do? So when people are in pain, how can I be the biggest help, and is there anything I shouldn't do?
Thanks for asking this question. On behalf of everybody who's going through a really hard time, I think we're all kind of leaning in right now of of hearing this. I would love to say to just hold space for somebody. We're not looking for all the answers. Oh, have you thought about this? Can you try that? Like, oftentimes that's not what we're looking for. We just need someone to sit with us and say the words, this must be hard. This must be sad, right? To just acknowledge the real hard feeling in the room, not come in and fix it, not come in and say, oh, you know what? My aunt would just went through something really similar. No, right now I don't care about your aunt. Hold space for me. And so oftentimes as coaches, what that might mean is the coaching has to go to the side. The goal, the work towards the goals has to kind of go to the side. And we just have to see the person behind the title of third grade teacher, 12th grade teacher, fellow instructional coach. And we just have to be with that person. I think that would be what I would say to do. And what I would say to not do is say this one phrase. Oh, I just can't imagine. Because what that does without the intention is, I don't know what the intention is, but what the perception could be to the person who's hurting is, you can't empathize with me. You can't put yourself in my shoes to understand the level of heartbreak that I am in. I can't imagine my child going through something like that. I can't imagine losing my mom. Well, that is actually that's my reality. I can't not imagine that. So what that I have found does, and I'm very mindful now when I'm sitting with people and holding space for them, to not say I can't imagine what they're going through, because they don't have a choice but to live through that. That's their lived experience. So hold space, but also not discount the pain that that person's going through.
So is it fair to say that what I try to do is feel inside me what I would feel if I was that person? And that means to some extent we have to be in touch with ourselves. Mm-hmm. So we can say, well, this too is in me. I feel this too. But if we I don't know if diminishing is the right word, but I can see, well, we want to let the person know we're with you and we feel it with them. Is that the idea?
It is, because it's oftentimes, let's say, Jim, you're going through something really difficult and I'm trying to hold space for you. It could be quite uncomfortable for me to be sitting with your unease and your sadness. It's not about me. It's not about my discomfort. And so as the listener, as the holder of discomfort, any way that we can depersonalize it, it's going to feel awkward. It's not going to feel right. We might see somebody in the grocery store who just lost somebody and we don't know what to say. It's not about our discomfort. You go right up to that shopping cart and you just hug that person and say, I am here for you. I am sorry for what you're going through. I recognize that this must be really hard or really sad. That's how we help people feel seen and heard and valued in their most vulnerable times. It's not about us.
That's so interesting. I interviewed someone for the Definitive Guide, and she talked about working with first and second year teachers. And she said she would go in expecting to talk about the data that she gathered or how the progress was going with the strategies. And the teacher, she'd sit down with the teacher, and the teacher would say, I just broke up my engagement. I'm not getting married anymore, or whatever it was. And she said, I just have to fold up my book, set it aside, and be present to the person. So I'm wondering, You're working a lot with second-year teachers. What have you been learning about your coaching work with second-year teachers? Maybe to some extent, your experience is the same. You have to be present to the person first and then deal with the strategy second.
Yeah, so here's what I was so excited that you were going to ask me about this. So our school district, and I would imagine most organizations, are really good at supporting first-year teachers. We bring them in during an orientation. We hold their hands all year. We help them lesson plan. We give them non-evaluative feedback. We love on them silly in year one. Then year two comes along, and now we're going to go help the new year one folks. And what we have found over the years is that a lot of our colleagues say, my hardest year teaching was year two, because it felt like all the support systems just kind of went away. And they weren't wrong, Jim. So what we have started doing this year is we have started making a very overt and concerted effort to support our year two folks, not in the same way as year one, but in a very structured and predictable way, so that it didn't feel like those training wheels just kind of wobbled off the road. And so what we've been doing is using your work, using our coaching cycles, but carrying the thread through year two. And it has just helped us so much do exactly what we talked about before in our conversation. Hold on to that relationship that we established in year one, continue it, strengthen it, and make sure that we are continuing on that collegial relationship in a really meaningful, authentic way. It's made such a difference in teaching and learning.
Can you give me an example of a strategy or something you're doing that's especially helpful for the second year teachers?
So what we've done is we bring them in during the school year. So all of our help for year one is after school. But what we got is release time for a fall semester and a spring semester to get teachers out of their room for the day, which, again, you know, the logistics of finding subs for these folks is a challenge, but it's worth it because we get them out of their classroom around other like-minded year two folks. And we've differentiated these groups. We actually have three groups, and depending on their former experience and their skill sets, we've differentiated them so that the time outside of their classroom could be differentiated. So what's so neat is everybody has a goal. Some folks, most of the goals are strengthening core instruction in reading and math for elementary folks. But then you have some people, their goal is, I want to explore more of a leadership position. Maybe they've come to our school district with 10 years of experience, and they're ready to lean into different things. What we've been able to provide through differentiated and personalized coaching cycles is meet folks where they are and help them have a say in how they want to grow professionally. So it's relevant and it's meaningful and it's meeting folks exactly where they are. So we've got a whole bunch of goals happening on multiple spreadsheets.
And again, this is for the times because we're losing so many teachers. And you're probably onto something. I wonder if year two is the number one time people quit. If that's the number one, it's probably first and second years, that's for sure.
Well, you know what? Our mentor program is really robust in year one, and then it falls off year two. Mm. And what the more research I'm looking into, without that mentor, that's when folks leave the profession. It's some wild percent. And I'm not going to share because I'm afraid I will get it wrong, but it's north of 70%. If someone doesn't have a mentor, a steady, predictable person, it's over 70% of people will leave in their first 5 years of teaching. We can't afford that, Jim. We need good people in classrooms.
That's definitely for sure. So I asked this question last year, so you can just give the same response if you want. But the question is, can you suggest one, two, or three strategies, questions, things we can do to be more effective as coaches, maybe to be coaches who are compassionate towards others, anything that comes to mind, a couple things you've learned that help you be really effective that other people could use too.
Is it terrible if I take it from something I learned at the teaching and learning conference last year?
No, I think that's great. Go for it.
So the other day, I had mentioned a group of instructional coaches got together, and those of us who were fortunate enough to go to your conference in October shared a big takeaway. And wouldn't you know that all six of us, was it six or seven of us, basically said the same exact thing. And it was because it was touched upon not only in your keynote, Jim, but then in many of the breakout sessions in their own iteration. And that was this: as instructional coaches, we want to be the helper, the fixer, right? But what we were really invited to consider at your conference was to not be an advice monster. And so that has helped all of us here in Central Bucks so much, because I forget which breakout session it was. It could have been Christian who said, your ideal pie chart is an 80-20. You want to be listening 80% of the time and advice giving 20% of the time. And if you're really mindful of that, and if you almost picture the conversation in this pie chart forming as you're speaking, that's what's going to make sure that your time, energy, and attention are on the right things for the person you are coaching. So it's not a Suzanne idea. It's a Jim Knight instructional coaching idea that 80 to 20 is a game changer.
Well, Michael Bungay Stanier's question. It's his idea from the book, from the Advice Trap. But I would say, even I'd go a little further and say it's 80% them talking, 20% me talking, but I don't necessarily give advice. I more ask questions. And the way I would approach it is I always position the other person as the decision maker, because they are.
Yes.
Just because I tell them doesn't mean they're going to do it. So I just, position isn't even the right way. I just see them as the decision maker. And so once you recognize that, to me, coaching is kind of trying to get into the decision-making with the person and think it through with them. I tell them what to do. There's a really good chance they're just going to nod their head yes and go do their own thing. So I'd rather have them safe in order to do it. And I think all the things you talk about would help me make it a more safe situation.
So and that whole looping strategy, right?
Yeah.
I have that right? Like, so good.
Yeah, I love it.
Just helps people feel heard.
I know. Amanda Ripley was great. And so TLC this year is going to be awesome too, New Orleans. So what do you know what you're going to be presenting this year? We're excited to see another standing room only.
Let's hope so.
Is your dad coming to the Big Easy for this one too?
Bless his little heart. He says he wants to come again.
Oh, good.
He's so cute. I know. So last year, it was called Coach Happier. And this year, it's going to be called Strategies. What is it? Strategies to support joyful leadership. So what's really been neat is that I've gotten to work in a lot of school districts and organizations, but also some organizations outside of the education world. And so I've been picking up on some of their leadership moves that absolutely matter and make a measurable difference to us in education. So I'm going to share some of those. Hopefully not up against your session again this year. If you know someone doing the scheduling.
I don't know. I don't know that I have any break. Oh, no. We're following up on that session. So last year, you were up against the one where Jim gets coached. Christian was coaching me, but still a standing room only group for you.
Yes, They still showed
up. So this year we're going to follow up and see where we are. So that's okay. there is that one breakout happening for sure. The cool thing about TLC is just the community of people. I guess to learn from people and meet so many great people. I'm so glad you're coming. Is there anything else you want to say before we kind of wrap up?
I'm just so grateful to be there. And if anyone who's listening is thinking about the conference, it is the most professional, well-done conference I've ever attended, which, Jim, I was telling you that at another conference, which may not have been the right thing to do, but and it's just such a powerful opportunity to be around other instructional coaches. I think at most other conferences, you're kind of looking for, wait, you're a coach too? And you know, become good friends with that person and strategize with your sessions. But the fact that all the sessions are specifically designed for us really transfers into positive change when you leave that conference and come back to work.
Well, it's a community. You know, people build community. And you're one of the reasons this becomes such a great community, because you bring such positive energy to the whole thing. So I'm grateful for your ideas, your book, presentation. Thank you so much, Suzanne.
Thank you, Jim. See you soon.